Good morning, Your Honors. Margaret O'Neill, 35937, for Mr. Abramoff and Ms. Alyarova, the appellants in this case. Your Honors, I requested oral argument in this matter for three particular reasons. The first is that I wish to answer any questions the panel may have regarding how and where the factual bases of our claims were presented to the trial court, both in the context of summary judgment proceedings and in the context of litigation of the issue of groundlessness and frivolousness. In other words, if there are any questions regarding what evidence was before the court during those points and proceedings, I want to make clarification of the citations that were made in my briefs.
Well, I'll take up your invitation, but cast the question slightly differently. In the plaintiff's summary judgment opposition, was there any specific reference to the deposition excerpts that might show a factual dispute?
There was reference only to the defendant's exhibits. In other words, the deposition experts that had been presented by the defense in their motion, but not any reference to lines in those excerpts.
Well, was there even a general reference?
Oh, yes.
Was there a general reference such as, Judge, if you read the depositions, you'll see a contradiction between the deposition testimony and the defendant's affidavits?
Yes, sir. There was a characterization of the exhibits as containing sufficient factual dispute. In other words, depositions.
A general characterization,
yes,
not a specific reference to the
deposition.
Not
a line reference.
Okay, related question.
Mm-hmm.
The defendants sought fees as groundless, frivolous.
Correct.
As part of their brief supporting their summary judgment motion.
Mm-hmm.
Did the plaintiffs make any specific argument that the case was not groundless or frivolous? And by specific, I'm distinguishing between a general saying that a general position that summary judgment isn't appropriate versus a specific argument, Judge, even if you grant summary judgment, our case wasn't groundless or frivolous. Was there such an argument?
Frankly, Judge, I don't recall if there was such an argument in the response to summary judgment motion.
Okay.
There was, of course, an argument made strenuously and repeatedly in the Rule 60 motion.
But that's after the judge has ruled.
That's correct.
Thank you. Please continue with your argument. So there are two questions.
I do want to also, my second purpose here is to reiterate that we are requesting that the court reverse the trial court's finding of groundlessness and frivolousness. Judge Webb, as the author, obviously, of an article on this subject, I'm going to ask you to just bear with my recitation of, I think, what case law is on point regarding the hearing requirement prior to a finding under 1317.103.
Did you ask for a hearing?
I did ask for a
hearing. Prior to that finding?
Did I?
Did you ask for a hearing prior to that finding?
Yes, sir.
Oh, wait a minute. Let me try to take the liberty of recasting Judge Daly's questions. Before the lower court ruled that the case, that the plaintiff's claims were groundless and frivolous, had the plaintiffs requested a hearing on fees? Before, note the timing in my question.
Yes, sir. No, a hearing was requested. Frankly, Judge, I would have to refer back to the response to summary judgment motion, but it is my position that a hearing was timely requested. The court made its finding of groundlessness and frivolousness in its order granting summary judgment without hearing evidence on that subject from any party. The court made specific findings which were cursory, incomplete, and inaccurate, especially with respect to the issues of discovery in its order for summary judgment. The hearing requirement, Judge, I believe exists when a court is going to grant attorney's fees.
Regardless of whether the hearing is requested?
No, sir. I'm aware of the case law, Judge, that is cited not only in your article, but also in our opening brief, which says that a hearing is not required sua sponte. It is not required either if there is going to be a denial of fees. But it is required, and it is an evidentiary hearing on the factors in Section 1317.103 that is required upon request of the parties.
So I have a question, again, and this is repetitious maybe, but when you wrote the response to the motion for summary judgment, you had in front of you the defendant's motion, did you not?
I did.
You had the deposition excerpts that were attached to that motion. They were readily available, were they not?
Yes, sir.
Yet in your brief, you do not refer one time to a page or line of either plaintiff's depositions, right?
That is correct, Judge, and my...
And the law says argument by counsel is not a factual assertion, you know that.
Mm-hmm.
And you must by affidavit or otherwise provide in 56 set forth specific facts showing a genuine issue of material fact in the opposition summary judgment, but wasn't really done here, was it?
Judge, I understand that it wasn't done with respect to the specific portions of the depositions that created conflict. I recognize, too, that the Roberts versus American Family opinion demands that the responding party or the non-moving party point out factual disputes.
And the judge said it wasn't done. Why is he wrong?
Because, Judge, the factual disputes were generally reasserted. Reference was made to trial record that refuted the affidavits of the defendants given in support of the motion. And reference was also made to the deposition testimony generally with respect to the existence of factual discrepancies.
Go ahead, counsel.
Frankly, it was my expectation that the trial court would read those exhibits and would recognize that they were both mischaracterized in the motion for summary judgment, and also that they evidenced abundant factual disputes. My view of the trial court's response to summary judgment proceedings is that the trial court was fixated on the idea that I must submit affidavits in response to defendants' affidavits. And I don't believe that that is a correct reading of the law. I don't believe that the affidavits that were submitted in support of the motion for summary judgment were sufficient to eliminate factual disputes. The case law is clear that the factual allegations of the complaint must be taken as true for purposes of summary judgment proceedings.
That's even when they're controverted by affidavit?
Yeah.
The controversy by the affidavit does not overcome the assertion, Judge. And in this...
So your position is you can rely on the pleadings alone to refute the factual averments of a counter affidavit? Pleadings alone will constitute a refutation?
As long as, Judge, the pleadings are factually specific enough to counter what's contained in the affidavit. So in other words, if the affidavit referenced additional evidence other than the mere word of the defendant,
a sworn word,
except that Rule 11 governs the truthfulness of a complaint.
I thought that Rule 11 governs the good faith behind the complaint, not the same as a sworn deposition or assertion of fact.
However, if I file that complaint, Judge, I stand by those facts as having been investigated adequately, as having been presented to me, as having been presented to me credibly.
But isn't that the difference between a verified and unverified complaint? I mean, if you want to make your complaint allegations immune from attack by counter affidavits, you file a verified complaint. Otherwise, the complaint's just an assertion of counsel.
That's fair, Judge. I would agree with that. Again, my position is not that you can rely solely on the pleadings, but that the evidence given, including the plaintiff's deposition itself, revealed the existence of continuing factual disputes.
Let me ask you about the attorney fees order for a while. Let's just assume that, okay, a hearing wasn't required because none was asked for earlier. Let's just assume that for now.
Yes.
What's wrong with the trial court's order still?
Well, first of all, the trial court did not adequately explore the factors in 1317.103. The court made no inquiries regarding certain questions that are listed in that statute. And the answers to those questions were readily available to the court. Even absent an evidentiary hearing where the credibility of the plaintiffs could have been assessed by a fact finder, by the court, there was evidence presented in our motions and evidence presented in the motions that were submitted after the order granting summary judgment, which would have answered those factors, which would have revealed that the court's analysis of groundlessness and frivolousness was incomplete, at least. And in our position, it was inaccurate.
Why haven't you waived that by failing to oppose the request for attorney fees is groundless and frivolous in the first place?
I don't think it's incumbent, Judge, upon the respondent to make a request for a hearing immediately.
Well, and I apologize if my question was perhaps ambiguous, because I think we've beaten the hearing thing pretty well into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate you indicated some lack of remembrance, but if the summary judgment opposition doesn't say one word to the judge, you should not award attorney fees because, why wouldn't that constitute a waiver of any defect in the form of the order?
In the form of the case?
No, I understand your argument now to be that the court's order was insufficient mm-hmm. because it did not enumerate the 6 or 7 1317.102 mm-hmm. factors. My question is, let's assume, I recognize you equivocated somewhat,
right,
that the summary judgment opposition contains not one word telling the judge why he should not award fees. Why isn't that a waiver of whatever defect there may be in the subsequent order awarding fees?
Frankly, Judge, I don't think that the question of groundlessness and frivolousness should even be entertained in the court's order regarding summary judgment. I think those should be separable inquiries. I don't think, for example, that defendants made legitimate arguments of groundlessness and frivolousness in their motion for summary judgment. And so, Judge, I think that an answer to the motion for summary judgment, arguing that the claims are both meritorious and that they should survive summary judgment, is sufficient to refute or sufficient to raise the issue that these are not groundless claims, these are not frivolous claims, these are claims that are not only warranted, but should survive summary judgments. They're factually grounded and they're legally sufficient.
Okay. Thank you.
I will save my last minute for rebuttal and invite any other questions at that point from the panel.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. David J. Moretta, caller of our 44409. We've got the appellees, Boris Fitkin, Pledge Brothers Pizza Corporation. Appreciate the time today. Respectfully, Your Honors, no matter how you slice and dice it, there are four reasons that we are here today. and these are the two appellants and their two counsel. The series of missteps in this matter is, I submit, remarkable. From their initial decision to proceed solely in the name of one plaintiff, yet casting allegations that are particular to the other, to the failure to post summary judgment with anything other than 3 pages of unsubstantiated argument of counsel. And yes, my sister counsel did refer to that decision as quote-unquote malpractice. To the instant appeal, the appellants and their counsel themselves have defined the bumpy path of this litigation. Yet at every turn, they seek to cast blame on everyone else. It's the defendant's fault. It was the trial court's fault. I certainly do not have the perspective of this panel as to the vast range of fact patterns that come through the doors of this honorable court. But I would submit that the utter lack of merit in the claims advanced in this case, including on appeal, surely must stand out to you.
Well, they don't quite stand out, counsel. I can understand some of the motion for summary judgment and some of the perhaps inadequacies in the response and the basis for the trial court's ruling saying, I don't see anything that's necessary under the rule to refuse the facts. But the request is groundless, frivolous. Seems to me is that even if the motion for summary judgment wasn't perhaps postured in the way it should have, the response, summary judgment perhaps postured the way it should have, in those depositions, and known to your side of the case, may well have been disputed facts. And so how would that make a groundless, frivolous case, when although may have lost the summary judgment motion, just losing the summary judgment motion doesn't make it a groundless, frivolous case, does it?
That's correct, Your Honor. It does not, and that's not what the trial court found.
And I think that was the only question I asked, but otherwise, the rambling that I had, if you could respond to that, I appreciate it.
Of course, sir. Thank you very much. The trial court's decision to the finding of groundless and frivolousness in the case was certainly not merely premised on the fact that the plaintiffs lost the motion for summary judgment. It was looking at the big picture, Your Honor, and the court referenced the moving target, they use that term, that phrase, moving target allegations of the plaintiffs in this case. And if you go back and look at the record over time, the trial court had plenty of reason to come to that conclusion. It was not just simply that there were 3 pages of counsel's argument tended in opposition to the motion for summary judgment. It was the overall picture, the fact that at this late stage in the case, they didn't tender any depositions, excerpts, they didn't tender any evidence. There was just simply the arguments of counsel. And there weren't even references to the record. There weren't even references to the amended complaint or the second amended complaint to direct the court's attention to. This was not just simply another, they lost the motion, therefore, entitled to fees. And by the way, to address the point that was raised during my sister's argument, in fact, in the motion itself, motion for summary judgment, defendants did, in fact, raise the issue of grounds for frivolousness in their claims and direct the court to pages 359 and 360 of the record. And the opposition to the motion for summary judgment does not address that issue of grounds and frivolousness at all.
It does not. How about the question or the position by counsel that the defense on the merits, arguing that there were ample grounds to defeat a summary judgment, implicitly oppose the request for fees on groundlessness and frivolousness?
I think it's incumbent upon non-moving parties to point that out to the trial court, Your Honor.
Explicitly?
I believe so, Your Honor. I think that the trial court has in front of it the record that's presented to it. And one of the reasons that the record was so thin in this matter, Your Honor, is that the plaintiffs sat on their heels for what essentially amounts to the first 10 months of this case and did nothing. There were no depositions taken prior to this time, which is why they didn't put in front of the court any deposition experts, an expert of their own that they had taken. We had taken the two of the plaintiffs, but the two defendants were not set to be deposed until after that. Yet there was no request by the plaintiffs to delay the case. There was no point raised in the opposition to the motion for summary judgment that the case was not yet right to be reviewed for summary judgment.
Counsel, you agree? I assume you would agree with the proposition that in deciding summary judgment, the judge can look at even matters submitted by the defendant to see whether there are disputed facts in those exhibits, right?
Of course.
One of the issues in this case was there a misrepresentation made about payment of the 2006 taxes, right? That's one of the allegations plaintiffs make.
One of the issues is, I believe it's 2003 and 2006.
Okay, let's say 2006.
Yeah. Correct.
In her deposition, didn't Ludmilla testify that she was told that all taxes were paid and you don't have to be worried about it?
She did say that in her deposition, but she was also asked very specifically about, because this goes back to the stock purchase agreement in particular, contains a very limited representation about that. And that was the basis of their claim, that the stock purchase agreement itself had been, that they had been misled into that, because the representation in the stock purchase agreement says that to seller's knowledge, and we're
saying right.
2003 and 2006.
But an oral representation was alleged to have been made, was it not? To Mr. I don't know, I'm sorry, I can't pronounce his last, to Isaac.
Abramoff. Yes.
And he was a plaintiff by the time summary judgment was written, right?
Neither plaintiff ever said that they were told that the 2003 or 2006 taxes had been paid, and that was the extent of the stock.
Didn't Ludmilla testify? Did Mr. Bitkin or Kurtzer ever say anything to you specifically about 2006 taxes? Answer, they say, I admit this English is not perfect, they say, we pay all taxes and you don't have to be worried about it. Isn't that a testimony that there was a misrepresentation made about taxes?
Your Honor, respectfully, the problem with the testimony of the plaintiffs is that they've said multiple conflicting things at different times. And I believe that the record that we presented to the trial court was not in any way misleading. We gave them the excerpts, and I think that, yes, she did say that the taxes have been paid, but the issue was 2003, 2006 taxes was a very specific carve-out and limitation in the stock purchase agreement about which taxes the defendants were representing had been paid.
Well, why does the stock purchase agreement supplant the oral representations that might have been allegedly made to Mr. Abramoff before it was signed? Well, he wasn't even a part of the stock purchase agreement.
Your Honor, the complaint and the amended complaint both allege, as basis for relief, that there was a misrepresentation about the 2003 and 2006 taxes, which is what the stock purchase agreement, the extent of the representation about that. So even if they told her the tax has been paid for other years, that's not the basis of their claim, as I understand it.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is, given the fact that it was in her deposition, what I'm more troubled by is, does the judge then have a duty to hunt through this deposition to look for contradictory facts, facts that could contradict the affidavits you submitted?
He does not, Your Honor. I believe my sister counsel acknowledged that with the Roberts versus American Family principle acknowledged.
He doesn't have a duty to do so. But didn't he do so in this case? Didn't Judge Crabtree look through this deposition? Because I find numerous citations to the deposition in his order.
He certainly did not just simply rely on our argument, Your Honor. I review that. He went through and gave an in-depth reading. It was very supported by the record and the evidence that we presented in front of him. Your Honor, just looking briefly at the three main issues here that appellants have raised on appeal, I'd like to start first with the denial of the motion for leave to amend to add new claims under Rule 121, Section 115, Sub 8. I guess I'm confused as to what it is that the appellants are really alleging was error here. They say that there is a sensible interpretation of Rule 121, 115, Sub 8 must accommodate the possibility that a conference does not occur. Well, that's true. In some cases, a moving party could seek to confer with the other side and just get no response. That happens all the time. So the issue is, okay, just because the conference doesn't occur, what's the error here? The fact is that the argument doesn't address the second prong of the trial court's ruling denying the motion for leave to amend to add new claims, and that is Attorney Furtado's misrepresentation or mischaracterization concerning what the extent of the amendments are. The appellants have listed no authority suggesting that it is error for a trial court to deny a motion that has been misrepresented by a counsel during the pre-filing conferral. They have not identified even a single case in Colorado or anywhere else in the United States in which such a pre-filing misrepresentation or even an innocent misstatement that inadvertently omits key aspects of the proposed motion has ever been excused. This is a novel and plausible argument. What was erroneous about the rulings? The fact is that the appellant's position does not address two key aspects of the rule at all. One is that the motion shall contain a certification that the movement has in good faith conferred with opposing counsel. The motion in this case did not contain any such recitation. There's a reason for that. Appellants also ignore the fact that the committee comment notes that the purpose of pre-filing conferral is to attempt to work out the difference prompting the motion. It's to allow counsel to narrow the items of dispute to the extent that they can. So the fact is, in this case, at no point prior to the appellant's filing of the motion for leave to amend claims was the fact that amend the complaint was the fact that the new claims ever even discussed with defense counsel. And there's a reason they didn't say good faith certification, because they didn't do it. So the fact is that Judge Crabtree granted the motion to the extent that it was identified by Attorney Furtado in the pre-filing conferral, and that was to only add Isaac Abramoff as a plaintiff. They have identified no authority that suggested this erroneous. Their position, even if true, they say, well, in some cases the conference doesn't occur and the reason can be stated why. It doesn't alter the outcome at all on this issue. This is just simply speculation. There's no authority or even factual argument that even makes sense on this. And I would submit that that argument alone warrants sanctions. Now, with respect to the grant of summary judgment,
$43,000 in sanctions?
Yes, sir.
That one would justify $43,000 in sanctions?
Forgive me. The sanctions on appeal here.
I apologize.
Forgive, I may not have been clear. Now, getting back to the case law, it wasn't specifically discussed by Ms. O'Neill during her opening argument, but I believe the cases that she's citing are Ellerman versus Kite, Ginter versus Palmer, Urban versus Beloit Corporation. And these cases stand for the proposition that in certain instances, a party opposing summary judgment need not tender affidavits in response to a motion for summary judgment, but only if the moving party has not established through the materials presented to the trial court that he or she is not entitled to summary judgment as a matter of law. And if you look at those cases, they involve an element we talked about, a conclusory statement in an affidavit where the court found that it was insufficient to show no genuine issue of material fact. Answers, interrogatories were made on information and belief, not on personal knowledge. And it's interesting that in the Ellerman case, which also cites Ginter, they note that it may be perilous for a party opposing summary judgment to neither proffer an evidentiary explanation nor file a responsive affidavit. And Ginter notes that the stubborn reliance on allegations or denials in the pleadings will not suffice when faced with an affidavit affirmatively showing the absence of a tribal issue of material fact. That's Ginter, 585, P. 2nd at 585.
Let me ask you a slightly different question.
Sure.
In your answer brief, you primarily argue that the error in the summary judgment wasn't preserved. Let's assume, I'm not asking you to waive any argument, let's assume we were to conclude that the trial court had an independent obligation to scrutinize the deposition excerpts and compare and contrast them with the affidavits the defendants put in. Do you deny that scrutiny would have suggested the existence of factual disputes given the relatively low standard that's necessary to defeat summary judgment?
I do deny that, Your Honor, and I believe, in response to Judge Rickman's claim, that I think that Judge Crabtree did, in fact, review these materials very carefully. There are numerous references to the testimony that was not just simply presented in our motion for summary judgment.
But let me ask you, on the example that Judge Richman gave you, is that not some evidence contesting or putting in dispute the issue as to whether or not there had been a representation about the taxes from 2003 to 2006?
Your Honor, when a party testifies in conflicting fashion at different points, and I believe that our motion for summary judgment identified very specifically what the evidence was to the contrary.
You did.
Yes.
But if we're talking about an independent obligation, we come across that part of the deposition, does that not create a dispute of fact for the jury to resolve as to on which occasion Ms. Alagrova would have been telling the truth?
Your Honor, I believe that, first of all, that's not what the case law says, but it is, as counsel concedes under Roberts v. American Family, her obligation to bring that up. And the trial court, we've looked at the record. I don't think that this was overlooked. And I believe that in this case, the trial court was looking at the body of evidence that was submitted and under oath, two affidavits from the two defendants in this case, and made a judgment call.
You still haven't told me why that does not create a material issue of fact, that particular testimony that Judge Richman indicated. Whether or not it's in conflict with other testimony, it conflicted with what your clients represented.
Your Honor, I don't believe that that's the case, but again, it was not argued to the court either way.
I understand. Yeah. I understand your point. It was not argued.
Yes.
The question here was, if you had an independent obligation to look at it, why wouldn't that have created a material issue of fact?
Again, Your Honor, I think it goes back to the issue of a general statement that she was told the taxes were all paid or all set or whatever it was. It's not specific to the issue was the 2003 and 2006 taxes in particular.
Okay.
And I think that's okay. That made the distinction.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you
very much. Thank you for your argument. So you have about a minute left. And we're going to up that to a minute 30 for you.
Judge Daly always wanted to be an NFL referee, you know.
Judges, I'm just going to quickly respond to counsel's characterization of our failure to include Mr. Abramoff as a party at the outset of this litigation. Mr. Abramoff is not included as a party to the litigation because he did not communicate to us his involvement in the dealings between the parties. However, 9 months after the litigation commenced, the defendants raised for the first time the existence of another writing, a second writing, which they claimed purported to be the memorialization of any agreement between these parties. That writing was the franchise agreement. It was not produced to us until June 2013. The plaintiffs did not have a copy of it. Mr. Abramoff's signature was purportedly obtained knowingly on that document, and that was never admitted by the plaintiffs. However, the inclusion or introduction there of Mr. Abramoff's involvement in the negotiations or in the discussions or in the formation of a contract between these parties was thereby made evident to us, and it was obvious that he needed to be added as a party.
Thank you, now, counsel. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments in this case. The case will stand submitted and the opinion will issue in due course. Thank you both for your arguments today. The court